All right, welcome back to the show, and thank you guys so much for joining us. And I teased the interview coming into this segment, and I want to kind of explain it before we get rolling here. So, because of everything that's going on, I wanted to. We've done a lot of interviews where we had, you know, things we wanted to discuss, but I wanted you guys to be able to listen to a conversation between two guys that manage money. And we're just going to riff. We're just going to talk about what we see going on, share notes, throw things back and forth. And I think, judging by who we've got with us here, who's one of the smartest investors I know, I think it's going to unearth a lot of stuff for you to get a better concept of what's going on and how crazy this really is. You're seeing the point movements in the markets, which are pretty nuts, but that's not even close to telling half the story. So, without further ado, I want to welcome Tobias Carlisle back to the show. Tobias is the author of Deep Value, Acquirer's Multiple. What's the other one, Tobias? I'm missing two here. You've got two other books. What am I missing?
Yeah, first one was Quantitative Value, came out in 2012, and Concentrated Investing, went and talked to investors who've got 25-year track records of outperforming. Nobody read that book.
I wish I could tell you I had, but I'm going to put that on my list. I'm flying down to LA tomorrow, so I'll be able to dial that one up. But just to tell you guys, one of the reasons I've got Tobias on is Tobias is the only other manager I have ever had manage a part of our value portfolio. That's how highly I think of him. And if you want to, Tobias can't talk about this, but I can. If you want to have a great value manager like Tobias running a part of your portfolio, you can do that. He's got an ETF out. Symbols on it are ZIG. I cannot recommend it enough. Very smart guy. Very great portfolio. It's a part of what we do. So anyway, without further ado, Tobias, welcome back. Great to have you. I want you to kind of just start off giving a rundown about what you're seeing. What do you and I have kind of DM'd about this back and forth on Twitter a little bit. What is really catching your eye here in what's happened this week?
Well, thanks very much for having me on, Zach. I always love chatting to you because I think you're one of the few guys who recognize that the market does have some downside risk. I think it's important to step back a little bit and think about really what has happened. There was a few weeks ago, really, this is only a couple of weeks old. And before that, we were all saying, where is the coronavirus volatility? We can see this problem sort of growing in China and throughout the rest of the world, but we haven't seen it in US stock markets. For a long time, they seemed to ignore it. And then they woke up on February 24 and decided that that was the day to start recognizing some of the risks. Since then, so we dropped very, very rapidly down about 15.5%. We've then bounced back, but we've had a lot of volatility. So I have this view that there has been enormous amount of like international weakness in fundamentals and in prices. And I think that the market has been looking for a trigger. And I think that coronavirus is the trigger. So right now, even though we're seeing these little rallies, these are what I would regard, you know, there's no reason why you can't have big rallies in the middle of a bull market. In fact, that's when a lot of them happen. In the middle of a bear market, that's when a lot of them happen. So I think we really have no view on whether this is going to look like a 2007 type scenario or whether this is a 2018 where it only went down 20% or 2016 where it went down even less than that. So I think until we're not really going to know until we're much more into this. That's sort of my sense. But I do think that we're in kind of no man's land at the moment. There's a chance that there's a trap door around here somewhere and we really take a big header.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, we're looking at that, and again, purely speculation on our part, but I'm really eyeing that 2873 level that lasted as an all-time high on the S&P. That level held for like 18 or 19 months. I'm not a huge technical analysis guy. Our analyst does the vast majority of that. We integrate it into what we do. That's not my forte, but I mean, you know, are you familiar with Michael Oliver's work? Jesse Felder did an interview with him.
I'm not, no.
Okay, so he does structural analysis, and he pinned his number was a close between 2977. That breaks the structural momentum trend that's been in place since 2009. So we've done that once already. He also said this 2 weeks ago. He said that if you break it, you will probably see a rally or even a series of rallies higher. But his opinion is that if you close below that, the damage is done. We're below it right now. We've already closed below it. So, you know, you and I both know when these guys throw out, and no knock on Michael Oliver. I think he does great work. Just these are hard, you know, nobody knows, right? I mean, it's we're all guessing. The one thing I think is interesting, Tobias, is and I don't know if you saw this, but I put out a tweet where if you step back and take a look at this, you got so many people sitting there calling for the, well, don't get out of stocks. You could see a bounce back to new highs. If we bounce back to new highs, that would be a solid chunk of multiple expansion. So that would require me to believe that not only can the markets maintain during the economic hit that they're taking. Now, we haven't figured out how severe that hit is yet. I think it's a lot more severe than is being played out. I mean, I know that for a fact. Talking to some of my friends that work up here in the tech industry, they're like, hey, you know, things went on ice 2 weeks ago and, you know, we're not seeing any change here. So, I mean, you know, there is going to be an economic hit. I just don't think the media is really talking about it in that way. And you're right. This risk just came out of nowhere for a lot of these people. But we're looking at this whole scenario, getting back to my point, which is, you know, I'm not convinced that the market has to fall apart. If you were to put a gun to my head right now, I would tell you that I think the odds are we're definitely going to go lower. The interesting thing to me about the bull thesis, though, here is, okay, you're not only saying that through a global pandemic that the market's going to maintain its value, and I think it's really important to point out that a global pandemic that happened while the global economy's been slowing for the last 14 months. So, I mean, you know, it's not like everybody's like, oh, this could cause a recession. Be like, well, guys, there's a lot of indicators that said we were heading that way anyway, right? So you want me to believe that not only can the market maintain its value level in here or its levels in here, but to reclaim those highs, that would mean that you're counting on multiple expansion in the face of a global pandemic. I don't really see it. I personally have never felt safer being short the indexes at this moment. Anyway, I'll kick it over to you. What do you think about that?
Look, I don't really follow the levels that closely, but I think about it like a value guy. So if you look at the market at the level that it is, the forward returns still aren't great. And if it just gets more expensive from here, which is, you know, if it goes back up again, those forward returns are still, we're still only looking at 2 or 3% nominal. That's your total return, including dividends per year over the next 10 years. And so that's not a really exciting, you know, the market on average has delivered somewhere around 9. So that's how far above we are that sort of long run trajectory. Then you look at what you've got coming over the next year. So we know that coronavirus is impacting supply and factories in China, and that's having a knock on effect. But when you think about how companies report, what they do is they report on this quarter in the next quarter. And so the impact has really only been in the last few weeks. So it's really only going to impact the tail end of this quarter. So the first round of reporting won't have the full impact of the shutdowns in it. We're not going to see that until we get to the third quarter when they report on the second quarter and the fourth quarter when they report on the third quarter. So I think that the weakness is with us all year long, and it'll show up in individual names having really bad quarters, and then they will get smashed to pieces. And I think that that's what happens over the course of the year. We get this sort of rolling bad news dribbling out all the time. We're going to have lots of little rallies through here, but I think that there's so much risk and we're so expensive that much more likely is that we're just sort of sideways and down for the rest of the year.
Yeah, the only wild card in here, and as you've probably been talking to clients and other friends in the business as well, the only wild card in here, honestly, central bank activity. I mean, and this is something that I wanted to throw to you because I don't want to be conspiratorial about this at all. But there's been a very, I've personally never seen anything like it. I was up till today. Well, you don't know this. I already told the viewers, but today is my birthday, man.
Congrats. Happy birthday.
Yeah, I turned 26. No, I'm just kidding. I told my kids that. I was like, you know, dad's turned 26. Anyway, so my wife put the kids to bed, and I got home last night, and she wanted to have just kind of like a nice dinner and all that kind of stuff. And I just told her, I go, honey, I appreciate it, but I got some work to do here, right? And so I was probably up to like 11:30, just, you know, looking at all kinds of different data points, reading stuff. And the thing that is, there's a ton of things, first of all, that's caught my eye. But a really interesting thing, first of all, and we'll get into this in a little bit, the rate move is obviously stunning. I've never seen anything like it.
Right.
I woke up this morning, we were 20% long treasuries. I woke up this morning and overnight that position was up 6.5%.
That's a scary thing, right? It's moving so much. I think it's the right trade, but wow, that is not a good, healthy sign for the market when that is slipping around like that.
Oh, no. I mean, it's pricing in a massive global recession. And that's the crazy thing is, you know, bonds are pricing in an apocalypse and equities are, you know, what are you, 12 or 13% off the high. But the thing that caught my eye was then I flip over to the dollar index. Now, I know you're a value guy, and so I don't want to push you out into, you know, waters that you're not looking at, and you can pass on it if you want to. But then I look at this and I go, you know, you've got this parabolic run-up in U.S. Treasuries, and over the same period of time, the dollar's dropped 4%. I've never seen anything like this in my entire life. Mechanically, I can't figure out how that's even possible.
How do you interpret that? What does that mean?
And this is where I was saying on the conspiracy side of it, I am not a plunge protection guy. I am not a market conspiracy guy. The only thing I could come up with, and you should see the ETF inflows. We had another chart I posted last night was a picture of the globe and where the ETF inflows are happening. And it's all flooding to the United States, right? I mean, it's like by a factor of like 10 over the next closest country. And I'm looking at this parabolic rise in yields. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, the only thing I could think of that made sense of the dollar drop and the spike in yields is you've got all these other central banks already at the zero bound. And maybe it's a coordinated effort to sell dollars. Right? Maybe they're trying to keep a lid on the price of the dollar. I don't want to be a conspiracy theory guy, but I was just sitting there going, you know, if you've got your back up against the zero bound, you know you can't cut because negative rates have been a disaster. What do you do?
Right.
Maybe it's a coordinated effort to sell dollars. I don't know. That's all I could come up with.
The Fed's Rosengren came out today and said the Fed might need to broaden the assets that it can buy. So I don't know what that means, but I've got this terrible feeling that that means buying stocks and buying equities through ETFs the way that, you know, the Swiss National Bank does it, the Japan Central Bank does it, the BOJ does it. That makes me very nervous that they would go to that sort of level and really take over the market. I hope that it doesn't get to that point. I think it's so crazy to be managing for the stock market. I think we should be, you know, there have been lots of stock market crashes through history. It's not necessarily a bad thing. It gives lots of people an opportunity to buy at lower prices and it sets up the next round of growth. I don't think that always pushing it back and damaging the entire economy, the entire financial system, just to keep the market propped up, is healthy or good. I don't think it's good at all.
Well, I mean, history tells us it's not. The BOJ has wasted three decades trying to do this, and that's the maddening part of all this, and we got to take a quick break, but I want to pick up right where we left off, because I didn't hear those. I must have been on the road. I didn't hear that Rosengren statement. But anyway, guys, we got to take a quick break. Stick with us. We'll be right back with Tobias Carlisle for our special today, Markets in Turmoil. We're ripping off a line from CNBC here. Be a little dramatic. But anyway, we'll be right back after this break. Stick with us. This is Know Your Risk Radio on 97.3 Cairo FM and AM 770 KTTH. All right, welcome back. And with no fanfare, let's just get right back into our interview. We got Tobias Carlisle with us, and we're doing a little bit of a different format. We don't have so much structure to this, but it's just two guys that manage money throwing things back and forth and trying to look at all the crazy stuff that is going on right now, because a lot of you are probably focused on the price movements in the markets. They are crazy, but there is much crazier stuff going on beneath the surface, and we're going to try to shine a light on that. So, Tobias, I want to pick up where we left off. I missed that Rosengren announcement. You said it was about 22 minutes ago, right?
It's only just come out.
What was it? What was the format? Was it an interview, or was he speaking already? And what prompted it?
It was a headline over Bloomberg. I just saw it tweeted out, so I don't have much more context than that. But that's a very worrying sign, I think.
Well, here's the other thing. You've got the Fed talking last week about how solid the economy is and how it's on such good footing. They do an emergency rate cut, even though their next Fed meeting is only a week and a half away. Now they're talking about buying other assets. What do they see going on that they're not telling us about, right?
Well, I'll tell you one thing that I think is kind of stunning. So the coronavirus is impacting travel, anything kind of connected to travel, OTAs, that's the online travel agencies, airlines, and so on. So the global airline industry is about to have its worst year in history. And that means it's going to be worse than 2001 after 9/11 and the financial crisis. And in 9/11, it took 3 months for travel to go back to normal. So who knows how long this one takes to go back to normal. But I think that these are very worrying signs, and these are not the sort of things you see close to the bottom of a bear market. This is the sort of stuff that you see right at the beginning. And the way prices are at the moment, I think that there's a lot more downside here.
Oh, I couldn't look. And you know, you and I have been having these value conversations for the last 2 years or maybe even a little bit longer. The other crazy thing about this is valuations. You know, there is one price metric out there right now that does not reflect historically high valuations. And of course, that's the only one that you hear mentioned on CNBC, which is the PE ratio. But, you know, to put that in context, you and I have discussed this before. PE ratio does not take into account the balance sheet, which corporations are levered to a historical amount right now. Never even been close to this. And then the other thing that I think that is just amazing that people are whistling past this one is this historic spread we see between GAAP and adjusted earnings. So my whole thing is, is it possible? I say this tongue firmly in cheek here. Is it possible that that record gap between adjusted and GAAP earnings gets resolved in favor of the adjusted earnings? Sure, it's possible. I'm going to take the other side of that 10 out of 10 times. So I think the one metric that is most impacted by stock buybacks, the PE ratio, is artificially suppressed. So I think this market is still nosebleed expensive, especially when you see what's going on in the world. Everybody's talking about how people are overreacting to this or people are panicking. I'm sitting there going, you basically had a euphoric blow off top over the last 6 months. All you've done is peeled that back. This is still the most expensive market in U.S. history. Yields are showing it. I'm quite honestly, I'm just shocked that it hasn't. And before I move on, I'll throw it back to you. But the other thing that I want to make very clear to people, you mentioned this earlier. I've seen and I've gotten calls on these 5% meteoric jump days, right? These bounce backs. And what I've been trying to explain to people is, listen, that is not a good sign, right? The market's gyrating either direction in 3 to 5% moves on a day-to-day basis. Even when you get the upswings, that is a classic bear market sign. I mean, what did we have?
Like, absolutely.
And didn't we have, like, you probably know the stats on this. I want to say we had like 6, 22% or greater bear market rallies during the financial crisis?
Yeah, we had, I think I counted from the very top in 2000. So I'd say about August 16 was the top in 2007. And then all the way to the bottom on March 3, 2009, I think you had 13 or 14, depending on how you count them, of these new lows. And each of those was preceded by this very material bounce that then ended up finding a new low. And those bounces can take weeks and months. That's the most frustrating thing about being in a bear market. I'll just say this about the volatility. The VIX, which is a measure of volatility, is now higher than it was in late 2018. So, it looks nothing like it did yet in 2009 at the very bottom. And we're kind of really only looking at, it looks sort of roughly like where it was in the early 1990s, which is a little bit more, in the early 2000s, which is a little bit more standard. So it's bounced a lot, but it's not highly unusual. Just on the earnings, I would say on the PE, I would just say this, three things to bear in mind when they're quoting those forward those PE numbers. They're always quoting the forward PE. So that's not earnings that they have actually made. That's what analysts think next year's earnings will be. And analysts are always too optimistic. What that means is that it flatters the earnings. The E in the P, it makes it look higher than it actually is, which makes the ratio look lower than it actually is. So every other metric, and you could look at a cyclically adjusted metric like the CAPE, and that would show you that we're still very, very expensive. We're sort of as expensive as it was in 1929. And the only other time in recent memory that it's been more expensive was the very late 1990s, 2000. And the reason that those PEs look lower than they actually are is because margins are at their highest levels in recorded history. So what that means is that, and margins are highly mean reverting.
Right.
So the reason that people use the CAPE is that the CAPE includes that margin. And so when that CAPE is elevated like that and the PE looks low, that's because margins are very fat and earnings are very high. And that's, again, that's the sort of thing you see at the end of a bull market, not at the beginning of a bull market.
Yeah, I some of these, and people, you know, you're going to hear the people out there saying, all these things have taken hits. I'm looking, well, you and I were talking earlier this morning about this. I'm sitting there, this is really, and I'm not going to say it's the absolute first, but it's the one where I've noticed the most interesting thing to me is we've got the NASDAQ down now 1.1% more than the Dow. That is very much a break from trend of the last 8 or 9 years, right? The NASDAQ has been, except for the end of 2018, the NASDAQ has not gone down as much as the Dow has, and it hasn't, and it's gone up considerably more than the Dow has. So it has been in the investors' benefit, right? Tech, regardless of which side the market was moving. A 1.1% differential between the two today. Now, again, none of these points in and of themselves mean anything, but the thing that's interesting to me is you are starting to watch, especially on today's tape, a lot of these high-fly tech companies that you and I both know, right? We refer to them as the compounder bros, trying to justify their 30 and 40 times sales prices they've got on these things. But, you know, you and I both know that the valuations on these things are absolutely insane, that if held long enough, they will produce big enough losses. I've got no clue what time frame that is. But these things are just starting to get hit today. You were talking about the short book, right? I mean, you're just seeing the shorts getting hit harder than the value positions, are you?
This is the first day where really the expensive, frothy names have taken a bigger hit than the market. And definitely this is a day where value is starting to outperform a little bit. I don't know if that's noise or if that's a sign of a sort of short-term bottom. I just say this. The first 10 years of my career from 2000 until 2010 was a period of time where extremely expensive stocks, even though they had very good fundamentals and earnings that were going up materially every year, they were flat for an entire decade because they'd been expensive from the 1990s. Then value stocks did very well through that period. The last 10 years has been a slightly different market where the better companies with the surging earnings rapidly growing have done very well for stock prices. And value stocks, because it's sort of paradoxical, but value got expensive in 2010, and it just has underperformed. But we can pull up lots of, there's free data out there that you can look at. Ken French, so he's part of Famer and French, very well-known quantitative researchers. If you look at their website, you look at something like price to cash flow is now actually, the value portfolios are now actually cheap relative to their long run mean. So I feel very, very good about value here. I think that there's going to be a lot of volatility before this is all said and done. And value could, you know, when the market goes down, value is going to track down with it. But I think value is going to be a safer place to be. And I think because in the fund we have the shorts on in the really egregiously expensive, junky kind of growth names, that's going to provide a lot of ballast and a lot of protection. That's what we've seen over the last 2 weeks. We're down a little bit less than the market, and we're down about half of what comparable value ETFs are down.
I don't think I saw that piece. Did you put that up on your Twitter feed?
Sorry, which one?
The Famer and French or
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I've put that up. I can pull the date for you.
Yeah, well, I can dig through too. I'd like to take a look at that. But no, and you, again, you and I have had that conversation too. Market cap to GDP, I think last I checked, we're still at like 160, 162, somewhere in there. Price to sales is still, you know, I think we're still above the 99 levels. I mean, this just is not cheap. Now, hey, flipping it over, do you ever recall seeing a move in rates like this? I've never seen it. I've just never seen a rate move of this magnitude.
No, it's hard to even find something like this in the backtest data, because the backtest data, really, in the high quality backtest data, only goes back to the 50s. And I think you sort of need to go back to something like 37 when they were approaching the zero bound then. And the data is just not that good because they didn't record the prices as well as they do now.
And then the other thing, now granted, rates are compressed, right? That's a given. But still, to see, what is it, in four sessions or something, the 10-year carved off almost 50% of its yield. I mean, sweet Mary. And again, we loaded up on treasuries 3 weeks ago. If I told you, I mean, I think eventually, and I've said this for a while, I think eventually the 10-year gets to parity or premium with the bund. That's my own thought on it. I just didn't think it would. I didn't think we'd move from, you know, 1.05 to 0.68 in two sessions. I mean, it's just breathtaking.
Yeah, I have to leave that macro stuff to you blokes who are a lot smarter than me. I'm a humble value investor, mate, so all I get to do is I keep an eye on individual names. I keep an eye on individual value names, because that's about all I'm capable of figuring out. And I've got to say, there's some crazy stuff coming into what I think are very, very deeply undervalued territory. So I hesitate to say it because he's been so beaten up for so long, but Warren Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway. So Buffett has famously said he'll buy back Berkshire Hathaway sort of up to 1.3 times book value. And then last time he said he wouldn't even use that as the floor because he thought that it was worth a lot more than 1.3 times book value. He's currently buying it for 1.15 times book value for one of the strongest companies in the world, run by the greatest capital allocator, the greatest investor of the last sort of 100 years, probably. So I think that Berkshire Hathaway is a pretty safe place to be at the moment.
Oh, I agree with you. The other thing that, you know, and you want to, obviously you want to leg into this sector carefully, you know, you don't, it's because the bottom on something like this, I mean, you're sitting here looking at oil down 10% on today's session alone. So I'm not, in no way am I advocating you back up the truck and start buying. But some of the valuations in in energy are just incredible. We nibbled on ExxonMobil the other day, throwing out a 7.1% yield. It hadn't thrown out that much yield since 85. we picked up the price of the stock below the lows.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And I just looked at it and said, you know, I don't know what this stock price is going to do, but we're effectively buying an inflation protected bond here, throwing off 7.1% yield.
And I couldn't agree more. I think there's some incredibly cheap energy names. I prefer ConocoPhillips. Before the big bust, they've been doing a very big buyback. They had a lot of cash on the balance sheet, been doing a big buyback. They've just announced another enormous buyback to the tune of $4 billion. I think if it gets cheap and they put that money to work, you know, out the other side, the world still needs energy. It's going to be a good place to be.
Oh, yeah. And that's the hilarious thing, is listening to all these people. You know, oh, well, oil's going away and nobody hates oil. And I was actually really looking forward to having this conversation with you, because I think it's something that people know anecdotally: buy low, sell high. They don't understand the psychology and the environment that produces that. If you are buying, and I want to turn this over to you, but from my experience and my perspective, if you're really buying value, it feels like you're running into a house on fire. Does it not?
That's right. That's exactly right. You have to buy when it looks gnarliest in whatever thing you're trying to buy. Every now and again, you get these half-generational opportunities, and this may very well be it. I don't know, but this could be a 19, 2018 style bounce where we only go down 20% and then it recovers immediately. But, you know, if it turns into something like 2007, 2009, you got to remember that thing, it ground on for a long time. It took 18 months before it kind of recovered. And we're really early days in this. So you're going to get better and better values as you go along. But equally, you know, it's hard to do. You've got two things that you've got to do in conflict. One of them is you've got to conserve a bit of cash so that there's something to fire when you get to the very bottom. But equally, you've got to take these opportunities when you see them. So that's why I just, the way that I solve it is I just do a valuation on these stocks. I know where I want to buy them. When they come in and we get that opportunity to buy them, we jump on them. If we get another opportunity to buy them later on, that's great. But right now, I'm just trying to ignore the volatility on a day-to-day basis in the market and just look at the things that I want to own and get my prices for those things. And so that's what we're doing. And so I feel good. I like this kind of market.
No, so do I. I was saying before in the opening segment, I was like, the listeners at home might think I'm a nut job or think I'm a glutton for punishment, which, you know, I guess we both probably
you
are.
May be.
Being value investors for the last 7 years has felt like, you know, I felt like Apollo.
Friend.
Oh, yeah. I felt like I was Apollo Creed trying to fight Ivan Drago. You know what I mean? Just somebody throw the bloody towel for crying out loud. But no, it was. And like I said, maybe I'm a glutton for punishment. But, these are what opportunities look like. The other thing I think, too, is it really, I don't know why it amazes me. It frustrates me. But the cavalier attitude that so much in the media are talking about this, and I think the really important thing that people don't ever stop to think about is that, going back to our friend Warren Buffett, one of his famous sayings is, you know, when the tide goes out, that's when you find out who's been swimming without their trunks on. And, you know, I don't think that the worst case scenario or the apocalypse – This isn't World War Z, right? This isn't the zombie apocalypse, right? That's not the issue. And so everybody's sitting there going, well, it's just the flu. And I keep looking at them going, you're missing the point, okay?
Right.
You're missing the point because this is slamming the brakes on an already slowing economy that has never been levered up more. And you've got China in the worst economic shape that they've been in the last 30 years by far.
100%.
Right? And they've produced 50% of the – just go pull up any 10Q, right, from any company and go listen to their growth strategy over the next decade and tell me how much of that growth strategy includes the Chinese middle class, okay? This is not something – and I've got – I don't know if you saw that thread that I posted – a while back, about right when this thing got started. It was the week before when we were still making new all-time highs. Talked to one of my friends that worked at one of the local tech companies here in Seattle. They asked me not to share it. I had to pull the tweet down because they got freaked out. It went viral in a hurry. But I was talking to them, and they said that internally, they've been talking to – he manages a logistics chain, a supply chain, so very topical, right? What he was telling me is, A, the supply chain was completely frozen. But the other thing he was saying is that this has already pushed management over the edge, that they are permanently moving big parts of the supply chain out of China because they were already concerned about pollution issues, human rights issues, things of that nature. And this was the straw that broke the camel's back. And he said that he was talking to his other buddies at other tech companies. They're all doing the same thing. The other thing that nobody, I think, is paying attention to is, what about the knock-on effects this has in China?
Well, I think there are two. I think you're absolutely spot on with your assessment of both of those things there. But I think that there's two issues with China. One of them is that it's the just-in-time manufacturing hub for the entire world. Right. And if you have something that needs a component, even a single component from China, and it's not available, you can't finish whatever you're trying to finish. So that disruptions are going to be global and wide-ranging, and it's going to take a long time to get through it. Then on the other hand, a lot, as you point out, a lot of the growth from a lot of companies is predicated on selling into China. And the Chinese, and you know, one company like that is Tesla, which I think has been emblematic of the last decade in the markets, but particularly the last year, where it's really, you know, it's a heavy metal bender. It's not a great stock. The balance sheet is terrible. It's full of debt. It's net cash flow negative. It's selling 2%. It's sold over the last 12 months 2% more cars than it sold the year before. So it's not a high growth stock by any stretch of the imagination. Even though they sold more cars, they sold them for lower prices. And yet the stock has been up fivefold this year, and it's barely come off really in this last sort of in this little bit of. We're now seeing some of the pain in Tesla today, but I think that Tesla is one of those bellwether stocks where once Tesla breaks, and that's one of the ones that I'm going to watch pretty closely, I really think that that's the signal for that risk is right off and we're right in the middle of a bear market.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. And it's not that big of a stock, but I just think that, like you called it the bellwether, I completely agree. It to me, it is the poster child of, you know, and I'm putting myself out on a limb here. I do that all the time. I'm not that worried about it. But I think that in retrospect, this will be the pets.com of this cycle, right? And I think when it goes, the psychological damage it's going to do to the vol sellers, the compounder bros, all the guys that we have enjoyed so thoroughly over the last 7 to 8 years, I just see that. Unless they've got access to capital, unless they're growing revenues, unless they got people pouring money into that thing, it's going away.
That's the risk. 100%. That's the risk. Like, they do have a real risk that there is no floor in that stock and it's a zero because it's carrying so much debt and it's not net, it's not free cash flow positive. So they're relying on outside financing. And so they should have taken advantage of that massive run up in the stock. And they did. They placed, I think, about $2 billion worth. But the rate that they burn it, they're going to need to go back to the market sooner rather than later. And so they really need this bear market to turn around in a very short order. It needs to be a 2018 style bounce and then back to new all-time highs. Because if it turns into a 2007-9 style thing that grinds on and on and on, their stock price is going to be a lot lower and they're going to need more money, and that's going to make it incredibly difficult to finance. So I don't know what happens in that scenario. Maybe they get bailed out by the Saudis or the Chinese, or maybe the US decides that it needs to prop that industry up. I don't know, but I think that Tesla is the bellwether, as I said before, and I watch it very closely.
You know, that's the other thing that I wanted to talk to you about too, because I think, you know, the listeners have the idea that, you know, I have guys on like you so we can talk about it and share information. The other reason I have guys on like you is because I enjoy the conversation. I enjoy the topic. But the other really interesting thing to me about this, and which is making my hair stand on end much more than any of the other threats that we'd had or any of the other scares that we've had over the last 10 years, is that, and again, you and I spoke offline. I don't want to put words in your mouth. But the language I was using is that the thing that is concerning, that's got my dander up about this whole move, is it's the collision of so many different things at the same time. And I think one of the big mistakes, and I've learned this just through experience, is the world can deal with a one-off problem, right? We can print over it. We can negotiate it. We can deal with it. You know, it's like the people that panic about the debt ceiling every single time it comes up. It might get some gyrations in the few days before, but you know how that situation is going to resolve itself, right? The world can deal with one issue. It's when you see all of these pressure points converging at one time. And I think China is a perfect example of that. I think Tesla is a perfect example of that as well. And there's so many of them, which is, you know, China's dealing with it on the exterior. They're also, everybody's talking about a China bounce back. Go look at China's trading partners. Right. I mean, Germany's one of their biggest, if not their biggest single trading partner. I mean, the EU is their number one trading partner. But I, if memory serves me, I believe Germany makes up the biggest chunk of that, which would make sense. You know, they were basically throwing up recessionary numbers before this started. So,
yeah. And don't forget Japan in there, too. Japan had a Q4 GDP print of -6.3% annualized, which, you know, that's a scary print where you're sort of expecting flat to 2% up for a year. -6.3 is really, really worrying. And that was pre-coronavirus. So who knows what the underlying fundamentals of the business world look like once the coronavirus really gets started. And it makes me very nervous, too. I'm with you 100%.
Well, and then you look at, I remember, I again, blown away that more wasn't made about that GDP print. I mean, Japan...
Well, they have explanations for it. They say, well, they introduced this new consumption tax, and that was, that, you know, that was a unique problem for Japan. The problem is you see weakness all over the world, and each little bit of weakness has its own, you know, all politics is local, right? So all, every little, every country, every market has its own explanation for why it experiences the weakness. And that's something you see in stocks too. Each stock thinks that the problem is unique to that stock. But if you take a step back, which you do, and which is why I like talking to you so much, you see that macro level. And, you know, I don't know necessarily what the cause of it is, other than we've just been in a very long expansionary period and these things come to an end of their own accord. It just seems that we're slowing pretty significantly. And the stock market was slow to catch it. But now that the US stock market has sort of seen it and doesn't like what it looks, doesn't like what it sees. And so we're sort of, now we're seeing the volatility.
Yeah, I, you know, this honestly, I think you said somewhere you like these kind of markets. I do too, because they, A, I think it's more fun as a man, as a money manager. You know, I was explaining this to my wife last night that to be a good investor, and it's something that I admittedly have a tough time with. It's part of the process and the discipline that is something that I know that I have to keep an eye on, which is don't do too much. You know, sit on your hands. You know, it's Jesse
Livermore.
Yeah,
couldn't agree more.
Right? Jesse Livermore. Most money I ever made was sitting on my hands. And that's tough. I love times like these because you can get in there and mix it up a little bit. But if I'm really being honest with you, this makes a lot more sense to me than 3 weeks ago.
I agree.
We were loading up on vol. We were long vol. We were long treasuries. I was just sitting there going, this is insanity. I mean, so I feel like this is more of a return to normalcy. This is, you know, this is a tape that makes sense.
Well, as I think we discussed it before, so ordinarily we'd run the fund 130-30, so it'd be 130% long, 30% short. In December, we took the exposure down to 120. And the reason for that, take the gross down, take the net down. The reason you do that, take the gross down when you see that sort of weakness and then take the net down, then you just can't be hurt as badly when you go through periods like this. The thing that is... that investors, and this is people who are investing for themselves, and professional money managers should bear this in mind too. You know, they say that there are decades in the market where nothing happens, and then there are days in the market where decades happen. And we're in those days where decades happen, and you're going to get these prices that are sort of once in a half generation opportunities, and you need to be have some firepower there to take advantage of them, and you need to equally have the firepower conserved so that when we really get the prices that, you know, you typically see at the bottom of bear markets, which is sort of, I think 2009, as deep as that was, it really only got back to long-term values. But I think this one, if we get back to long-term values a little bit below that, that's the time to be fully invested. You need to have everything in the market and you're going to feel sick doing it, but that's the time to do it.
Oh yeah. I tell the story of 2009, and that was my first real macro event managing money, and we went to all treasuries in November of 2007, and I wish I could tell you it was because I understood that treasury up in a liquidity crisis. I wish I could tell you it's because I knew Lehman was going to go under. I didn't know all that. What I knew was that nationwide had, countrywide had gone under. Bear Stearns issues were already in the fore. Maybe they had already been dealt with at that point, November 2007. And I just saw what I thought was clearly a real estate bubble. And I moved into treasuries as just a way to sit back and avoid what I thought was going to be some pain. It turned into a lot worse than that. And treasuries went through the roof and ended up sitting on a really nice profit there. But then you fast forward to May of 2009. And I remember sitting there looking at all these different companies, you know, safe stuff, you know, companies with pristine balance sheets, you know, nat gas pipeline type deals, oil company, you know, stuff that I knew was going to be there that was still holding up and had great balance sheets and their stocks had been obliterated so bad. You know, we were picking up 13, 14% yields on some of these things. And I'd love to tell the story like we knew that it was going to go through the roof, but that was still one of my most painful buying moments because it felt like the world was still coming unhinged. And it felt like you were running into a burning house and it felt insane. Now you fast forward a year later and that portfolio was up 102% in 12 months.
Yeah, it was a good time. I think the thing to remember as you're looking at individual companies through this period is you really want to be in stuff that, you know, ignoring the share price, because the share price is going to get beaten up. You're never going to get the bottom of anything that you buy, but you want to be buying stuff that is financially robust enough to survive and to thrive through a period like this. So you want to be in the thing that its competitors are getting weaker and it's taking market share and, you know, potentially buying competitors through something like this. So that's what I always look for. I want a pristine balance sheet with cash, strong free cash flow, sort of no matter what happens. And then management who know what they're about and know that, you know, this is the time to buy back stock. This is the time to take customers. This is the time to take market share. This is the time to take over competitors. So that's what we try to put into the portfolio, that sort of strong stuff. On the other side, we're putting in the stuff that, you know, is the weakest stuff out there. That it's either going to need help from somebody else or it's a donut.
You know, another one that I want to bring up, and I don't know if you and I have discussed it on air, but you know, you and I have discussed it. I know you know our position on Boeing and the show we did March of last year before the second plane went down. And I think anecdotally that is such a good example, not because we were right. I've been wrong plenty of times before, but because this is what happens to companies that are priced to perfection. This is why guys like you and I say, no, avoid it. It's priced to perfection. Nothing's going to behave perfectly. The world isn't perfect. When something's priced to perfection, take a step back, get some levity, get some, you know, get the whole picture in and pull back on it. Look at that thing. That thing printed at 260 today, or 258, I think, is where it bottomed out at.
Yeah, I take my hat off to you there. I think you were way ahead of everybody else and in correctly identifying what was going on after you sort of explained to me the situation, Boeing, because it's not something, it's not cheap enough to come into my screens. It's not something that I would seek out to buy. So I haven't followed that closely, but I really appreciated your insight into it. After you spoke to me and said they've been working to sort of goose the earnings and do other things, I went and looked at the longest term of return on invested capital in Boeing. And so Boeing's had pretty modest to good return on invested capital up until a few years ago when return on invested capital just spiked through the roof. And the reason that happened was because they were goosing earnings. And you don't want management engaging in those kind of shenanigans. That's just, it's not good for companies. And it's a shame because Boeing's a really old, well-respected company, and they've done something in there that, you know, hopefully it hasn't damaged it permanently, but it's certainly going to damage the reputation of Boeing in the short term and damage its fundamentals in the short to medium term.
Well, and then the other thing that really worried us, you know, first and foremost, thank you, but, you know, it was so much easier for us to dig into it just being local. We had access to so many more people. And when you hear people in the senior accounting department echoing what machinists on the floor are saying, that's kind of rattling, especially when it runs completely counter to what you're being fed from upper management and the Jim Cramers of the world and CNBC. And,
right.
You know, and it's so consistent. I mean, even the wrench turners on the floor knew about the $800 a share price stock goal, right? And you and I both know, I don't know about you, man, but there are two things that freak me out. CEOs going after shareholders and CEOs targeting a price of a stock. I just have never seen it turn out well.
Business. I'm with you 100%. Don't worry about the stock price. Run the business and the stock will take care of itself.
Oh, amen. And now, right? Boeing just came out with that announcement. Their timing has just been atrocious. It was like 3 weeks ago where they had that news conference and they were bragging about all of the planes they were going to be selling to Asia. And then, I don't mean to make a light of it at all. We've got friends, family that still work at Boeing, but this is the pernicious aspect of this. This is the nefarious part of it that gets me so fired up. Boeing is seen as this blue chip, this stalwart, right? This example. And I ran into people all the time, less now, thank goodness, but man, that had 80% of their retirement assets in Boeing alone. In Boeing alone. That thing's down. I mean, it's off what, 40% from its highs already? I mean, and Tobias.
And probably not done yet.
No, everybody was looking at it at 325 saying, is there value here? And I said, we were looking at it and going, guys, it's more expensive now than it was at the high. When you look at the orders lost and you look at the damage to the brand, all that kind of stuff, balance sheets in worse shape. They had to borrow $12 billion. I mean, again, it's in worse shape. And you know, I think this thing, I think a bottom's, you know, who knows, because it often overshoots, but I think the bottom's more around 140, 150. I don't.
Yeah, that was my sense too.
Yeah, I just don't think it's done. If you get it back to that normal valuation range where it, I mean, if they want to keep planes in the air, they better return to the way they used to do things. I don't think it's in danger of going out of business. But the one thing we've been telling people is, look, if you want to own the stock, own a reasonable size position, like not over 6% of your overall portfolio. And that's really what concerns me about this, because I don't, you know what? I was not running money through the tech bubble, and you were more involved at that period of time. Was the concentration in such few names as widespread then as it is now?
Yeah, I actually started work on April 2000. So I was a lawyer at that stage, and I came in expecting to do sort of IPOs and venture capital, and all of that went away when the market collapsed. And so what I saw was all of the takeover guys from the 80s come back as activists and push these companies that had been really beaten up, that had raised some capital in the frothier times, to sort of do something with it, to pay it out or to liquidate if they were a really bad business. I'm with you on Boeing. Like, I think it is a great long-term franchise. It's a great brand. It's a great business. And I really do hope that they can clean up the mess that they've got there, and they'll look healthier from a fundamental level sometime in the future. I don't think that we're there yet, and I don't think that the stock price is really enticing enough to take a gamble on it at this point. I'm with you that I think value, I agree, the value's 120, 30, 40, somewhere in there. And so if, you know, with the way that it looks at the moment, I would want it at a pretty healthy discount to that before I'd be willing to take the asymmetric bet on it, because I don't think it's a zero. I'm with you there. I don't think that and I don't think that anybody would let it go that far either. I think it's a better company than that, and it's more important than that. But I just, looking at the stock price where it is now with all of this weakness, it makes me nervous.
I agree with you, and I think that, and again, we've said this before, but I think you know, you can't put 100% probabilities on anything, but as close as you can get to 100% probability, I would place on it staying in business. I don't think it's got any threat of going out of business. I don't think the U.S. government's going to allow that. It's too key to national security. That's not the issue. But the issue is, you step in here and buy here, you could be sitting on some impaired capital for a very long time. God forbid you didn't back up the truck. A funny story, man. You'll appreciate this as a money manager. I actually got fired by a client because I told him to sell his Boeing stock at 370. No kidding. I got fired. Have you had any of these stories? I before we go, our time's getting a little compressed. We've still got some time, unless you need to leave. But have you had any of those experiences during this run? Have you had any of those painful departures where people looked at you and just said, look, this market's passed you by?
All the time, because the type of value that has been rewarded in this market is a sort of higher growth compounder value. And folks are saying, well, why do you own these companies that don't look like these companies don't grow as fast as everything else? And I say it's anomalous that those really high growth companies are rewarded like that. What tends to be rewarded is finding mispricings. You want to find something that's worth a lot more and it's trading for a lot less. Be very confident that it's still going to be alive 3 to 5 years later. So it's going to survive through the period. And then you just sort of hope that over that period, the market recognizes the big fundamental difference between the price and where you think the intrinsic value is, and it closes up. Hasn't been rewarded. It usually is. And I'm very confident about the future.
Yeah. Yeah. So outside of energy, and you don't have to give specific names, I don't want to get you in trouble, but anything else that's caught your eye already? Anything else that you're seeing through your, is what I refer to you, the viceroy of value? Anything else that's catching your eye?
Well, I had a conversation yesterday with Tweedy Brown. They're celebrating 100 years as an investment firm. They've been managing outside money since 1968, one of the most famous names in value. They were Benjamin Graham's broker. They helped Warren Buffett buy Berkshire Hathaway. Great company. And I was talking to those guys, and I want to go back to it again, because I just think I'm flabbergasted that a deep value guy like me gets an opportunity to buy a company like this. But I think that Berkshire Hathaway is one of the cheapest companies out there. It's just absolutely bulletproof from a financial perspective, run by one of the best investors that probably the world has seen. and you get to buy it at this price below where he has said that he would buy it. To me, that's screamingly good value.
Oh, I completely agree with you. The other thing that I don't know if you and I talked about this. Maybe you're the one that pointed it out to me. But what really got me kind of fired up about Berkshire, and I gotta swallow some crow here on this one, and I gotta admit something to you. We needed some liquidity in the portfolio, and I dropped Berkshire about a week ago. Now we're gonna pick it back up, right? I just needed some more wiggle room to maneuver these things. But the other thing that is I think people need to keep in mind is that it's not a perfect fit. It's not a perfect analog. But a period of time that was very similar to this that we've already discussed was the tech bubble. And there was that famous article that came out in 99, Warren's lost his touch. Did you see the article written by the exact same journalist last December? It was almost 20 years to the day. Maybe you sent it to me.
He's trying to ring the bell twice.
Oh, my goodness. I just sat there and looked at that and went, boy, I don't know whether to laugh at this guy or be shockingly impressed at his gravitas.
What's for punishment?
And not only that, right, just on the cusp of the tech bubble popping, but then the run that Berkshire went after that, because that's the other thing that we're looking for here, and it's hard to quantitate. Now, I want you to explain it a little bit more, but when you go through these vicious moves, if this is the beginning of a bigger down move, which I believe it is, when you come out the other side, one, I think the biggest mistakes is to buy what just worked. People aren't going to do that. Their hands are already burned.
Right.
They've got the scars. They're going to pivot to the other side of the other side of the aisle, aren't they?
Well, I think that, the reason that you get the opportunity to buy Buffett cheap and the reason that there are articles like that is because value as a strategy hasn't worked that well for the last decade, which is something that happens. It's hard to understand if you're not in this stuff all the time, that is not an indication that the thing is broken. Because what happens is strategies get expensive. So value is a strategy. Value gets expensive and cheap. And value was expensive in 2010 because it had done so well through the first part of the decade. It's one of those funny things where it's hard to imagine this, and it's kind of paradoxical, but value itself was more expensive than growth and on a forward PE basis. So what that means is that people thought that the value stocks were going to be doing so much better. That's always a bad sign. I didn't know it at the time. It's something I'm aware of now. But now I look at it and value is cheap to its long-run mean. Value is very cheap relative to growth. Warren Buffett's having nasty articles written about him. And Warren Buffett's investment company, Berkshire Hathaway, is extraordinarily cheap because it hasn't gone anywhere for so long. All of that stuff tells me that we're just about – this is the sort of – this is the environment that tees up incredibly good performance for value. And I think Berkshire Hathaway and Buffett will be restored to – where they had been regarded sort of a decade ago in the next few years.
Well, and here's the other thing that gets me excited about that is that you look at the bankroll he's got right now.
Right.
When this does tip over, old Mr. Buffett's going to probably go on his last big spending spree. And I'm not missing out on that boat. Now, like I said, I still got to admit to you that I did sell the Berkshire, but we're watching. We're gonna add it back.
You got to rebalance.
Oh, absolutely, sir. We just need a little room. We need a little wiggle room to do this, just because there were so many short opportunities. Here's the other thing too, and I don't remember this at 2018. I can't remember. We're starting to see spreads widen here, pal.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. This is if you hold a gun to my head and you say, what is this? I say it's more like a 2007, 2009. It's just that, I've been through a few of these that things were starting to look enticing and the market bounced so rapidly that there was just not that kind of opportunity. Didn't ever get to that point where it was like, looked good to a deep value guy. In this one, I can see names that definitely are way too cheap, but I think that there's still a lot more to come. And I know that we're going to get to that point where the baby gets thrown out with the bathwater. And that's the time when you just need to be going on an absolute feeding frenzy, which is why I want to be holding Berkshire too, because I think Buffett will be on that feeding frenzy. He's one of those investors who's going to do the right thing. And Berkshire Hathaway has the firepower there. They're going to get stronger as this thing rolls on, which is the kind of company that you want to be in.
One of the ones, and I'll make this the last one. I know you got to get rolling here, but one of the ones that I've been talking to you about this for quite a while, that has surprised me a little bit, that I figured, and maybe Buffett is just determined to wait for a secular buying opportunity. But I've been kind of surprised that he didn't swoop in and pick up PACCAR. It just seemed like it had Buffett written all over him. Do you realize that in the last 4 years, their revenues have grown by 50% and the stock hasn't moved?
That's crazy.
And we did a comparison on the show of it and Broadcom. Now, granted, they're completely different companies, right? They do different things. But if you want to get a good laugh, look at Broadcom next to PACCAR. Look at the balance sheet. Look at the revenue. There's actually a lot of similarities in terms of the capital structure and the, you know, things of that nature. Look at the revenue growth, and then look at the stock performance. It's really amazing.
Well, there was a great interview with Buffett a few weeks ago. He does those. He sits down with Becky Quick for extended 2-hour interviews every now and again, and you really get to hear the way he thinks. And so I love listening to those sort of interviews. I really got the sense that he thought things were expensive, and he was just, I think, even though he could see a few opportunities, I think he was implying that there were something really interesting coming, and I think that he's probably licking his chops at this.
Oh man, well, you and I are. I think the biggest message that I want retail investors to take from this is that, you know, I don't think, and it sounds like you're in agreement with me, but I don't think this is something that's going to be over in the next 2 to 3 weeks. It does feel bigger to me just based on the what we're seeing in the VIX, what we're seeing in bonds, what we're seeing in treasuries, what we're seeing in currencies, what we're seeing in demand in general. The other thing about it that to me is just eerie is that you absolutely had a sentiment peak right before this happened. I mean, the timing of it is so cliche, right?
Yes.
Virgin Galactic was going nuts. Tesla's going nuts. And no knock on any of my clients. I love you guys dearly. But one of the things that I notice is in the last 5 months, it has been the first time that clients were calling demanding that I put some of these stocks in their portfolios.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we did for a couple. I was able to talk the majority of out of them, but we stop lost those positions that they did put on, thank God. And we got out of there with minimal damage up until this point. Now, one last thing before we got to let you go. I'm just milking this if you can't tell. What is it that you're keeping an eye on right now? What is the thing or a couple things that you're watching? Obviously, you're intent on value. You're focused on value, which is one of the reasons why I have you, you know, helping us out in our portfolios as well. I love that. But what are the things that you are watching that you want to see happen that will convince you that this is a bigger issue than just a transitory market drop?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I'm always working from the bottom up. So I'm looking at individual names and I'm looking at industries. I think that, I sort of said it before, but I really do think Tesla is the bellwether for this because they've got all of these issues at the same time. One of them is that, you know, it's a metal bender. It's not a software as a service that is sold over the internet at net marginal cost of zero. They have to build to grow. They have to build factories. They have to build cars. They're expensive and they're hard to do. You've got to service them in the aftermarket. There's a big liability attached with that. On top of that, they're carrying an enormous amount of. On top of that, their net cash flow negative, and still the stock has been. You know, the stock is down more than the market today, but there have been many days where it hasn't been down as much. And I really do think that it's sort of the stock that is beloved by Robin Hood account type holders. And I think that when the fear really gets to those kind of investors, it's going to show up in Tesla. And when Tesla breaks, all hell breaks loose.
You know what's funny is while we're sitting here talking, the S&P was just whispers away from 2873, which was the high it put in at the beginning of 2018, right before the volpocalypse, right? The volatility blow up happened. You know, one of the things that I'm wondering, looking back on this now, is if you look at the events that transpired since then, maybe that, and I remember at the time thinking, look, I think the first sign of this whole thing coming off the rails is the implosion of the short vol trade. Look at what's transpired since. We're back to that level. We were just basically wiped off 2 years of gains. I'm just wondering if in time we might see that as a countrywide, you know, that was the first the first verberation, right, or the first rattle through the system that kind of got things off course.
Yeah, it's entirely possible. It's going to be very interesting to see. I think that this kind of volatility, there are going to be some hedge funds blowing up, and there are going to be some companies that really start getting hit through here. So that's how you know that this is getting a little bit more serious than a 2018 style drawdown, where it becomes a little bit more exacerbated and it shows up in the fundamentals more than, you know, it's not just stock prices getting cut to pieces. It's companies reporting really bad numbers for earnings and needing to raise capital. And the airlines are certainly about to, they're getting some sort of quasi bailout package where they might not have to pay tax for a few years. You know, this is about to get real, I think.
Yeah, it sure looks that way. And like you and I were talking about, it couldn't be happening at a worse time in terms of the way all the,
right.
I mean, geopolitical deals, right? You know, look at the turbulence, the volatility that any presidential election cycle brings in. I mean, you know, they're not always bad years, but we're certainly up against it, and I certainly do not think this is the end. So anyway, hey, pal, I really appreciate you joining us again. This is Tobias Carlisle. He runs the Acquires Multiples Funds. You can get his funds. Look up the ticker ZIG, ZIG. It is a part of our value portfolio. Pick up his books. They can also follow you on Twitter at Greenbacked, GREENBACKD. And didn't you have a book called Greenbacked?
No, I had a blog called Greenbacked. The book that I've got at the moment is The Acquirer's Multiple. It's $10 on Kindle, $15 for the hard copy. And it just describes what I do in very simple language, in very simple terms. You can read it in a couple of hours.
Yeah, and it's a great...
Available on Amazon.
It's a great read, guys. And again, if you're the home gamers, the piece of advice that I'll leave you with is read that book and study up on value investing, because something tells me it's going to come back into vogue and you're going to want to know. You're going to want to revisit those principles. And because it hasn't died, it never has. Buying things below intrinsic value is never going to be, it's never going away. So anyway, Tobias, thank you so much for joining us, man. And I hope to catch up with you again soon. And in the meantime, I guess we'll just be spectating markets and see the way this unwinds, huh?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Zach. It's great to talk to a risk guy, get a little therapy session in while we see this volatility in the market.
Oh, yeah, and good times and seeing some value back on the screen, man. I got to tell you, it's a bit refreshing.
Good luck out there.
All right, pal, you too. Thanks again.
Thank you.
All right, buddy, you still there?
Yeah, mate, that was awesome.